WMUB's first home was on Miami University's campus. 15 years ago, it became part of Cincinnati Public Radio and moved to rented space on Central Parkway. Now, we're building a dedicated home for our local public radio stations in Evanston. Follow our progress at cinradio.org/move.
No matter who wins the race to represent Ohio's 2nd Congressional District, a political newcomer will be heading to Washington, D.C. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Republican Congressman Brad Wenstrup decided not to seek re-election after serving 6 terms in the House of Representatives. Now, 2 candidates who've never held elected office are competing to represent the district, which extends from Claremont County east across 15 counties in southern Ohio. Joining me in this recorded interview is Samantha Meadows, the Democratic nominee for Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited. Thanks, Lucy.
We're happy to have you. We tried to invite the Republican nominee, David Taylor, for an interview, but got no response. What are you hearing from people out in the community? What are they saying they're most concerned about as you talk to them?
Well, the economy. The economy and jobs, human rights, you know, women's reproductive rights. And the one thing that I'm consistently hearing is that people are just tired. They're tired of the vitriol, the hatred. They want to get back to business, you know, the business of governing and be in the United States, you know, not what we're seeing right now. So it's kind of the pulse.
You mentioned the economy, and so many national polls, whether it's Kaiser or Pew or so many others, say the economy is the top issue for voters. How do you think Congress should address the struggles families are facing with higher prices and other economic pressures?
Well, first of all, they need to address anything. You know, we have the 2nd least effective economy in, Congress in modern history. So they need to get themselves together to start doing what's right for the American people. But, you know, I think that we need to look at price gouging. You know, when you have businesses, billion-dollar businesses that are making record profits and the people in the United States are suffering, you know, having a hard time finding affordable housing and being able to pay for groceries. You know, we have a systemic problem, and it's people manipulating the process.
Are there any particular bills or legislative proposals you have in mind to address that?
Not currently. You know, being a newcomer, things are a little different because, A, you don't know what powers you have, actually. You don't know how to wield them yet, and you don't know the mechanisms. So, you know, it's difficult for a newcomer, but what I lack in experience, I do make up for in enthusiasm and commitment.
Yeah. If elected, how would you work in Congress to increase access to affordable health care?
Well, I am, you know, as popular as unpopular as it is, I am for universal health care. I believe that we have a responsibility to make sure that our citizens are well cared for, and that has been one of the big failures of our government. You know, how do we do that? I am not sure. You know, and I have to be honest with you. I didn't come in here to BS you and say, you know, I know the solutions. I don't. Again, the mechanisms are I'm inexperienced with. I'm not in Congress yet. But I think that's something we need to focus on because we should not live in a country where folks can't afford prescriptions, where they can't afford cancer treatments, where we have kids, you know, that are diabetics. And we can't afford epinephrine, you know, EpiPens. It's unconscionable. And so, you know, when I decided to run for this office, it was to help people. And so whatever I have in my power as a congresswoman, I will wield to help people in that sense.
What, if any, federal legislation would you support related to reproductive care and abortion?
Well, first of all, I would vote to codify abortion access into law. I'm terrified of what could possibly happen if our Congress, our Senate, and our presidency falls into the hands of extreme MAGA candidates. And I'm not even talking about conservatives. I love a good conservative. I have them in my family. but I do, and I have a lot of respect for true conservatism. But where we're at now, where we don't have the ability to debate, where we don't have, well, even Republicans that will sit down for a debate or an interview, it's so polarized. So you know, 100% I would vote for enshrining women's abortion rights into law. Mm-hmm. And if we should fall, you know, Congress, Senate, and presidency into the Republican majority, I do fear we'll have a national abortion ban. And that's something that every voter needs to think of when they go to the polls, simply because the laws that were passed weren't even capable or weren't well thought out of the ramifications, you know, not just for abortion access, for, you know, what happens when a woman gets ill, when she miscarries, is not able to carry. Terrible. I can't believe we're here. I can't believe that we're in that place in history where that has fallen.
It's been more than a year since the Hamas-led attack that killed more than 1,000 Israelis in the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. The Israeli counterattack has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. What should U.S. involvement be moving forward?
Well, I think we need to push for a two-state solution. I understand that Israel has the right, you know, to defend their country, but at this point, you know, you'd be hard pressed, and I think you would be hard edged to say that we don't have a crisis in Palestine. You know, I'm a normal person, first of all, and when I watch the news and I see what's going on there, I see there's children, there's families displaced and dying. You know, I do want to mention that I did an interview at NBC4 Spectrum in Columbus, and we briefly talked about this. And my opponent, you know, Mr. Taylor, had said that he didn't trust the numbers of the dead in Palestine, and that they were reported by Hamas, and so he couldn't take those literally or seriously or whatever. And that disturbs me, because I do value human life regardless of, you know, where you're at in the world. So, yeah, a two-state solution is where we've got to get, and we've got to get there quickly.
As a member of Congress, what laws would you support to address gun violence?
Well, you know, I like to talk about this. People kind of try to deter me away from it. I'm a Southern Ohio girl. I grew up different than a lot of folks over here in Cincinnati and even in Claremont County. And I always kid, but I kind of mean it, that if you want gun reform, that is, you're gonna please people across the board, you need to bring the gun owners into the conversation. Because what a lot of folks don't understand is in urban areas or suburban areas, the response time for EMS or police officers is about 7 minutes on average. When you go out into rural America, you're looking at 25 to 45 minutes. So we have a different type of gun culture. You know, people are attached to their granddaddy's guns, and they don't want that taken away from them, and I understand that. And for a lot of us, we don't get it. We don't get how people could be attached to a gun. And the fact is it's cultural. So In the groups of folks that I talk to, and even family members, they don't want to lose that right. But at the same time, they also don't want to see children, you know, shot in schools. It doesn't have to be one or the other. You know, they're not mutually exclusive. So in order, I think we need to take the politicians out of it. I think we need definitely to take the NRA out of it. And I think we need to bring in regular folks who are responsible gun owners and have the discussion and start writing the laws around the people. Can you imagine us doing that? But yeah, there are solutions. But again, you have to get special interest groups out of it. And our Congress is clogged up with those special interest groups. So until we get people in there who want to pass meaningful legislation, I don't see us making any headway until we get those folks in office.
As you've been kind of doing your homework for this race and preparing for your campaign, is there any legislation that you've seen in Washington, D.C. that you think has that common sense approach or anything you know right off the bat, hey, I'd support this or this, I wouldn't support that or that?
I have not. You know, there are bits and pieces of everything. You know, you pick out this and you say, oh, that sounds good or that's atrocious. But no, I've seen nothing. You know, yes, the red flag laws, you know, those kind of things. Yes, you see those bits and pieces. But I've not seen anything that, again, brings the gun owners into the conversation. You know, the generational gun owners. I'm not talking about the guy that went down the street and bought it from the pawn shop for the first time. But no, I've not seen any of that. But it's something that weighs heavily on my mind. I'm a mother, you know, and we have to fix this. I think at the very least, there should be a moratorium on the sales of assault-style weapons. And then, you know, we can hash it out as we go. But for the present, we need to do that yesterday. Yeah, we got to save our kids. You know, that as someone that worked in EMS, I wish, and this sounds somewhat grotesque, but for every one of the mass shootings, I think members of Congress should have to see the effects of it. And I think it would bring it home a little more to them because I've seen that. You know, I've witnessed that. I've taken care of that. And it's easy for them not to personalize it, you know, until it's personal, until it happens to someone that they love. And so, you know, if that's what it takes, we've got to make them personalize this issue and understand that these are our kids, these are our families, and, you know. Yeah.
Immigration is also a major issue for some voters this election. Some people have concerns about the number of undocumented immigrants who are entering the country. What should the federal government do or be doing about immigration policy?
Okay, well, let me start with this one. When people ask me about immigration, I always like to tell them straight up that the wall is the craziest idea I've ever heard of. You know, General Patton said fortification are the monuments to the stupidity of man, and that if folks can get over mountain ranges or across oceans, they'll get past anything that is man-made. And, you know, this is an ancient China. We need to expand the border control. We have airship. We have drones. We have technology, right? So Border Patrol will, you know, create jobs and immigration courts. Let's have more judges, you know, and let's find a compassionate, empathetic way to help those who are seeking asylum and, you know, be what the United States is, you know, a welcoming country, but at the same time, a country that has to have rules, law and order to get into our country. I do want to mention something. Have you heard of the HA program? Is it the HA program? I sat down with a hog farmer, one of the largest in the state of Ohio, and he was telling me how big his farm was. And it was just so structured. And I was like, how do you handle the workload? And, you know, these are his words. He said, Mexicans. And I got nervous for a minute, and I looked at him. I said, can you explain that to me? And he was telling me about the visa program, where he brings up skilled workers, and he talked to me about how that is not taking jobs away from Americans, and how they are with him on his farm for 3 years. Now, they can leave and go to different farms, but they form almost like a family with the farmer and his family. So, you know, I don't know if people are aware, you know, when they think of immigration, you know, we've got these polarized ideas out there of what it means to immigrate. And so, no, we have structure. And if we need to make sure we're doing more of that appropriately.
You're running for the second time in a district that traditionally votes Republican pretty heavily. What is it about your experience and your background that you think will convince people to vote for you and support you?
I am one of them. You know, I have the same shared values. We're a different people down in Southern Ohio. Now, once you get out of Claremont County and start especially getting down to the southeast. You know, I'm originally from Scioto County. And, you know, we have shared values and experiences. You know, we had these thriving communities. We were New Boston Steel, it was the coke plants, what we called it, was right down there in Scioto County. We Ironton Steel Mills, up in Meigs County and Jackson County and Vinton County, we had the mines. So, you know, I was a young girl growing up when those shut down. And so I know what it's like to watch your communities that you had boat races and all these exciting things going on, you know, year round. I watched it move into socioeconomic decline. You know, I was a part of that. And then I was a young EMT in the early mid-90s when OxyContin moved into our, and it was targeted. You know, we had a large prescription rate for painkillers, as did so many of the mining communities. And they targeted us and they came in. They said, oh, this, you know, this wonderful pill is only 1% addictive. And here we are 30 years later. And this is why I ran for office, is because I worked on the streets. I can remember my first OxyContin overdose. It was a young man about my age. And I remember we walked in, we, you know, did everything that we had to do to try to save his life. And Narcan was only on the trucks at that time. Not everybody had it in the community. And we pushed the Narcan, the kid woke up, and, you know, we were like, what did you take? And he, you know, told us OxyContin. And of course, we reamed him out a little bit about it. But at that time, people didn't understand that it was extended release. So you had to go to the hospital because you're going to re-overdose again. Regardless, the young guy said, you know, I'm going to the Marines next week. And I was just partying. And I was like, okay, don't ever do that again. 2 months later, I coded him again and he didn't make it. And that's not unique to it. So again, when I decided to run, I was reading about overdose rates. And we had jumped like 286% right around 2020. And I said, you know, somebody's got to do something about this. And then something washed over me and said, you know what, do something about it. And so, you know, that was initially the reason I ran. And I care about the people in my district. I want to see our lives improved.
If you do get elected, what will be your top priorities?
Well, right now, I mean, public education, workers' rights, and women's rights. And, you know, all those are intertwined as well into the poverty issues that we have. They are also intertwined into the addiction issues. But I am very proud to say that I have more endorsements from labor unions than any congressional candidate in the state of Ohio. And I have to tell you a story about that, if that's okay.
Sure.
Well, being a first timer in 2022, when I decided to run, we had 7 counties. And I thought, wow, these are along the river. These people are like me. And then it exploded because of gerrymandering to 15 1/4 counties. So I did, the only thing I knew to do was go to the people, you know, go everywhere that you can. I went over in Meigs County for a meeting, and a gentleman was a retired mine worker, and he said, you know, Samantha, would you want to sit, you know, to consider being endorsed by the United Mine Workers of America? And I said, sure. So I went over there, and I walked into a room of about 50 aging miners, and they all had their veterans hats on or their UMWA hats, and their arms were crossed, and they looked really gruff. And they asked me, you know, the kind of questions you are. And I told them about the addiction issue. And then they looked at me and they said, would you march with us? Would you picket with us? Would you rally with us? And I said, heck yes, I would. So I went out into the hallway, and then they voted me in. And they asked me, you know, they called me up in June of 2023. And I did exactly what I said I would do. I got on a bus with 20 miners from West Virginia, drove up to Malvern, Pennsylvania, and marched for our brothers and sisters at Warrior Met in Alabama. So I walked the walk and I talked the talk.
Well, I've been talking with Samantha Meadows, the Democratic nominee for Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Can I also say something, Lucy?
Sure, real quick.
There's this wonderful gentleman named Larry Cadle. And he's out in Highland County, and he deeply admires and respects your show and you as well.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll have more on the race. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We continue our election coverage with more on Ohio's 2nd Congressional District. Joining me in this recorded interview to provide some analysis of the race is Cincinnati Inquirer watchdog reporter for Butler, Warren, and Claremont counties, Victoria Morwood. Thanks for being here, Victoria.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about the 2nd Congressional District. It covers a lot of territory.
It does. It includes 16 counties, starting with Claremont County, which has some eastern cities that we would maybe consider greater Cincinnati, thinking Amelia, Batavia, New Richmond. And then it goes all the way over to the border of West Virginia and Ohio. So it is a huge district.
Yeah. And what's the political makeup of the district?
So it is a very red district. Just for some context, Brad Wenstrup, who is the current representative there, won in his last cycle with 74% of the vote, actually against Samantha Meadows, who's running this year. It was also Trump's most successful Ohio congressional district. So it he got 72% of the vote in 2020 there.
Hmm. We just heard from Samantha Meadows, as you mentioned, that she's the Democratic candidate for the 2nd Congressional District. Tell us about the Republican in the race, David Taylor.
Yeah, David Taylor, he is a business owner. He has lived in the district all his life, according to his platform website. He is consistent with a lot of GOP policies when you're looking at his stances on abortion, immigration, and the economy.
Okay. Well, and we heard from Samantha Meadows about where she stands on abortion access. Tell us a little bit more about what David Taylor has said about the issue, where he stands on that issue.
So he calls himself pro-life. He did not say on his website whether he would support a national abortion ban. So I don't know, but he is staunchly pro-life.
Okay. What is his position on immigration?
He wants to continue to build the Trump-era wall on the southern border. He also wants to further fund border control on the southern border and the northern border as well, actually.
Okay. What other national and local issues are coming up in this race from the candidates?
Yeah, so although these are two very different candidates, they're polar opposites on several issues, there are a few things that both of them are driving home. So one thing is promising jobs in the district. It's a very rural district. To do that, Taylor has said he wants to increase access to broadband internet, which he thinks would help make a difference there. Meadows, on contrast, has said she wants to make federal grants and loans more accessible to small business owners. They also have actually talked about the border, both agreeing on sending more funds to border security. However, Meadows differs, and she does not want to continue to build the wall.
You know, you mentioned this is a predominantly Republican district. Samantha Meadows has already run in the district and lost once before, although she was running against an incumbent, obviously, mm-hmm. against Brad Wenstrup. How competitive can this race be? Do you have a feel for that?
I mean, just looking at the numbers, I would say David Taylor is the favorite in just looking at the numbers. He won a very crowded primary. He got around 26,000 votes or 25% of the vote against several Republicans in the primary, whereas Meadows ran unopposed in her Democratic primary and she got around 15,000 votes.
Okay. Well, that tells you right there with those numbers. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer watchdog reporter for Butler, Warren, and Claremont counties, Victoria Morwood. Thank you so much for your time today, Victoria.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue our program after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. Scores of women have taken to social media with their experiences of pain when getting an intrauterine device, or IUD. Now the CDC has issued new federal guidelines urging healthcare providers to address the problem. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. So what do the guidelines recommend, and what should patients know about IUDs, their safety, and whether there are any risks? Joining me in this recorded interview to address those questions and discuss the role IUDs play in reproductive care are University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Priya Gersahani. Thanks for being here, Dr. Gersahani.
Thank you for having me.
And New York Times reporter Alisha Haridasani Gupta. Welcome, Alisha.
Thanks so much for having me.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Dr. Gersahani, I want to start with some basics. Can you just explain briefly how an IUD works and what kind of procedure is needed to use an IUD as birth control?
There are two types of intrauterine devices, or two categories, I should say. One is a non-hormonal IUD, and the second one is a hormonal IUD. These are small T-shaped devices that are inserted inside the uterus. The copper or non-hormonal IUD works by creating an inflammatory state to prevent sperm from fertilizing an egg, thereby providing contraception. And the hormonal IUD thickens cervical mucus to prevent sperm from entering the uterus. And both are over 99% effective. So they're one of our most effective but reversible types of contraception. The insertion procedure can be done in the office or in an operating room, and it involves inserting the IUD through the cervix into the uterus. And generally, it shouldn't take more than about 5 minutes.
And how common is it for patients to have pain during the IUD placement procedure?
I think pain is a very individual perception. It can be uncomfortable. So I always tell patients that it can be uncomfortable because the uterus is a muscle that will cramp in response to something entering it. And so there are different ways to try to manage that pain.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, what have you found in your reporting in terms of how common that discomfort or pain is for women?
Well, I think it's very common from my reporting, and you know, my reporting is based on both data and anecdote as well. As you mentioned earlier, social media platforms are just sort of flooded with videos of women commiserating over painful insertions and even removals. And a study published this year scanned TikTok for the top 100 videos with the hashtag IUD and found that 97% of them highlighted the pain of the procedure and the negative side effects. So, you know, there's not much positive reviews of the IUD out there. And when we published our piece online, we heard from so many women across the internet as well on our social platforms and in our comments section of just how painful it can be, and also how their pain and anxiety was dismissed by their doctors. I just wanted to give you a few examples of the comments that we received, if you're open to that.
Yes, please.
Okay, great. So someone wrote in saying, when I had an IUD put in about 9 years ago, I was told to expect nothing more than a mild cramping. As I drove myself home on the interstate immediately after the procedure, I started having cramps so extreme that I started blacking out. And, you know, she was able to pull off on the side of the highway and, you know, and sort of take some time, but that was a dangerous situation that she was in. Someone else wrote, did anyone else pass out? You know, so a lot of this is maybe we're hearing from sort of extreme cases who are really passionately sharing their experiences, but it is pretty common. And I want to add that a survey published last year also found that only 4% of physicians are really offering sort of an injection of a local anesthetic. So you have this common experience of pain, and you have a very small number of physicians trying to mitigate it.
Dr. Gursahani, you know, Alicia was just talking about these videos. I imagine that can be very frightening for women who are considering this form of birth control, which you said is very effective, a very effective non-reversible form of birth control. Where should patients go for more information? Where, if they see these videos and they're worried, what would you advise?
I think there are certainly reliable sources online besides speaking to your physician. The CDC website is a very reliable website, or there is another one called bedsider.org. You know, with social media, you have to be careful because you have to know the background of the source providing the information. And I would encourage people to investigate who is providing it, whether it is a healthcare professional or a non-healthcare professional. But, you know, talking to your physician, I think, is always best.
Yeah. The CDC has now issued new guidance for doctors related to placing and removing IUDs. Talk to us about what's changed in the CDC's guidance.
So I think the CDC really wants to focus on patient-centered shared decision-making. And in the statement that they recently issued, it's focusing on who are candidates for IUDs, considerations of the timing of placement, and there's a large focus on pain management during IUD insertion and a review of some of the data to support that.
And is that because of the statistic that Alicia mentioned, that only about 4% of physicians were offering ways to mitigate that pain?
I would imagine so. I'm guessing there were enough complaints that led to them making this statement or feeling that it was needed to state something, which in my mind should be obvious because it is a procedure. It's an intimate procedure, and we should always be considerate of pain.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts, Dr. Gursahani, about why more physicians haven't been having those conversations with their patients? And I'm going to ask what, full disclosure, might sound like a sexist question. I wonder if male doctors are less likely to have those conversations. They don't have uteruses. Like, what do you think is the explanation there? Or do you have any thoughts about that?
I think because the insertion can happen very quickly, I think assumptions are made that, oh, it's really quick. You should be able to suck it up and get through it. And, you know, we know now that that's not the correct answer, especially if it is causing enough fear to make someone not want to consider that option, which may be the best option for them. It's hard to say whether it is a male or female provider issue, because I've had some patients tell me that they thought their male provider was more compassionate than a female who, and I think it goes both ways. You know, if you're a female physician and you've had an IUD, maybe that gives you perspective to be more compassionate. Or maybe for you, you have a higher pain tolerance and it wasn't terrible. And so you think everyone should feel the same way. So I think it's very individualized.
Yeah. Alicia,
I want to add to that.
Please do.
Actually, I think from the comments that we heard on our piece, it kind of comes back to gaslighting of women's pain and concerns in the medical world. This is a problem that sort of has cut through history for so long. I worked on another story in May about the tenaculum, which is the scissor-like tool that gynecologists use to grasp onto the cervix during an insertion. And, you know, it's a very commonly used device. Every gynecologist has that, but it is one of the tools that greatly contributes to the pain of an IUD insertion, and its design dates back to something like the Civil War. So that just goes to show you that there hasn't been innovation in this space either to try and mitigate the pain, and it's sort of seen as like not important enough. And I think that the CDC also kind of hints at that. They highlight the fact that these guidelines are based on data from recent studies, which are only just coming out, you know, in the last decade or so. And so the medical world is kind of playing catch up here. And they also note that the evidence isn't of such great quality that they can say with certainty that this will or will not reduce pain. And again, that speaks to just how little research and investment has gone into women's health.
We're talking this recorded conversation about the pain some women experience with the placement of IUDs and new guidance from the CDC to address those concerns. Dr. Gursahani, how do you talk with your patients about IUDs? What's the conversation you have?
If a patient is interested in an IUD, I ask them what would be concerning to them about the insertion and how we can try to make it less stressful. We talk about their options for pain control during insertion, whether it be premedicating with ibuprofen, whether using a cervical block of lidocaine, that per the CDC and per the data that we do have can be administered either via injection, or there is some data to say that topical sprays or gels can also be utilized. We talk about whether the patient, you know, based on their history, whether they have a history of trauma, feel like they can undergo an office procedure or would need additional anesthetic and be done in the operating room. I also offer patients, if they can have a driver, we can give them stronger pain medications or an anxiety medication so that they are then able to feel more comfortable with an office procedure, but they cannot obviously drive home afterwards. And then we review the side effects of the IUD, the biggest complaint for the hormonal IUD being irregular bleeding. We talk about the medical benefits of the IUDs in addition to contraception. We talk about ways in which we can try to treat symptoms if they're having them rather than just removing the IUD right away and giving it a little bit of time for their body to adjust. Any medication that someone starts, you know, it takes a little bit of time to see how it suits you because everyone responds differently. And then we talk about if they really don't like it, we remove it and we try something else. Mm-hmm.
Are there questions that you hear most commonly from patients that patients most typically have when they're considering this?
A lot of people bring up friends or family members who have had insertions and some of the concerns that they might have had. A lot of people want to know, how effective is it? Will it affect my fertility in the future is a very common question. And then if there were to be a complication such as an expulsion or a uterine perforation, what the next steps would be in that situation.
Alicia, how much more common have IUDs become as a method of birth control?
You know, it's funny that you see all these negative reviews on social media because CDC data shows that the IUD usage has gone up, actually, since I think it's up until 2019. From 2015 to 2019, I think it's gone up by something like 20%. And so that's showing that, you know, despite the pain associated with it, that women are opting for something that is highly effective and also something that they can put in and forget about. You know, that's the beauty of long-acting contraceptives. This the IUD, you can keep it in there for up to 8 years. And so it's sort of a one and done for many women.
Dr. Gursahani, how safe and effective are IUDs? We've talked about how, you know, this procedure can be painful for some women, but what are some of the benefits of IUDs?
IUDs, regardless of the type, are over 99% effective at preventing pregnancy. And as I mentioned before, they are reversible contraceptive methods. So upon removal, patients can then try to get pregnant again if that is their goal. They are also used, for example, the copper IUD can be used for emergency contraception if it is inserted within 5 days after unprotected sex to prevent pregnancy. And the hormonal IUDs, particularly the 52 milligram IUDs known as the Mirena or the Lyletta, can be used to treat medical conditions such as heavy menstrual bleeding that may result from fibroids or other conditions of the uterus.
And what potential side effects are there?
The biggest side effect of the copper IUD can be some heavier or crampier periods for the first 6 to 9 months. It does allow women to have a regular menses every month, which some people prioritize. And for those that do not want hormones, for example, maybe a patient with breast cancer who cannot take any hormone, it is very safe and effective. For the hormonal IUD, The side effects can be irregular bleeding, which is the most common complaint, though about by 4 to 6 months, many women stop having periods. And for many people, that's a goal, to have menstrual suppression. Occasionally, I've had patients complain of pelvic pain due to their IUD or mood changes. But generally, those are far less than other types of contraception, which are more systemic.
Alicia, in your reporting, did you see data with the people that you interviewed for all the reporting you've done on this, a difference between what women experience if they have already given birth and then have an IUD placed versus women who've never given birth and have an IUD placed? Is there a difference in pain or discomfort experienced among those populations?
So I'm going to read you one of the comments we received from a reader, and that will definitely answer your question. She says, I've had two completely unmedicated vaginal deliveries, and I put my pre-childbirth IUD insertion right up there on the pain scale with unmedicated vaginal birth. So I don't think there is much of a difference. I mean, scientifically, they say that there, you know, it is slightly less painful if you've had a child. But I've heard from many women that it sort of is as painful as giving birth, and the pain doesn't go away after giving birth.
Hmm. Have you heard from patients, Dr., about, you know, that difference? And I guess I'm thinking of women who have given birth and then have an IUD, because your cervix has been through something after you've had a vaginal birth, and I wonder if that makes a difference.
The data does say that parity makes somewhat of a difference when it comes to pain, and that patients who have never been pregnant or who are nulliparous have slightly more pain with insertion. However, you could have a woman who has had a child but maybe had a C-section and never dilated. So it's not a safe assumption to say that just because someone's had a baby that their pain is going to be less. I think anecdotally, when they're placed postpartum, within about 6 to 8 weeks after having a vaginal delivery, the cervix is a little bit softer and more compliant, and those patients tend to tolerate it, or have at least told me that their pain has been better compared to if they had one prior to pregnancy. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be offering them all the pain control options.
Mm-hmm. Just to add to that, I think a lot of women opt for getting the IUD, you know, right after delivery, while they're still in the hospital, and if they had, you know, pain medication, it sort of just makes it a little bit easier to get the procedure done. But again, as mentioned earlier, after 6 to 8 weeks of giving birth, and your cervix is sort of back to what it was, it can still be painful to get an IUD.
Mm-hmm. If we place them after delivery, we ideally do it within 10 minutes of delivery. And so often if a woman has an epidural or you're doing it at the time of C-section, they're numb, but the expulsion rates are slightly higher. And also, unfortunately, insurance coverage can be a little bit different depending on whether you're privately insured or have Medicaid in terms of coverage for IUDs placed within the hospital. Mm. Mm.
Dr. Grassani, talk to us about the pros and cons of hormonal birth control and non-hormonal birth control, and how you work with patients to find the best option. You mentioned that there are some patients for whom hormonal birth control isn't a good idea. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So I think a lot of it is individual preference. There are medical conditions I mentioned, very few, though, for progesterone, where perhaps a woman has had breast cancer that's progesterone receptor positive, who should not be exposing themselves to progesterone. Progesterone in general has less risk than estrogen, which is the other hormone commonly found in oral contraceptive pills or the patch or the vaginal ring. And that has several contraindications that we have to be aware of when we're assessing a patient for contraception. Part of it depends on patient preference of if they've had hormones in the past and felt side effects from them. Part of it has to do with whether or not they want to have a regular period. Culturally, it is in some cultures, it's important to patients to have that. So we talk about the risks and benefits of both. We talk about what their menses are like, because if they already have very painful, heavy periods, that might guide our selection. Or if they're having heavy enough bleeding causing anemia, then I might not want to put something in that's going to make that worse.
Yeah. Alicia, you've heard from a lot of people who've had bad experiences with IUDs. Obviously, you've done a lot of reporting on this. How important a role do you think IUDs play as a reproductive health option? What's your take on that?
So despite what I just read, you know, what I read you earlier, of all the comments coming in of how painful the experience was, we also heard from hundreds of women who have written in saying they love their IUD. They absolutely, you know, yes, it was painful, but they're so grateful that they could put it in. And, you know, not only did it prevent pregnancy, but as Dr. Grassani said, it helps with a lot of other things. You know, we did another story a few months ago about the use of birth control pills, you know, for the same reason, because on social media, you'll find extremely negative content about the pill. And it, you know, it would lead anyone to assume that women are quitting the pill in droves. But our own analysis found that they weren't. and that in reality, usage of the pill has been actually trending upwards since 2018. And I mention that story because I think that that's what's happening with the IUD as well. CDC data only goes up to 2019, but I don't think that women are sort of abandoning this option, particularly against a backdrop of restrictive abortion rights around the country. My reporting has shown that women are really taking their contraceptive care very seriously, and many are stocking up on the pill, others are getting their tubes tied, and, you know, I think the IUD plays a big role in their ability to control their reproductive health because it is so long acting and because it is so effective, and women are really being proactive and choosing a really highly effective form of birth control here.
Do you think those comments that people see online, whether it's complaining about the pill, quitting the pill, or, you know, really talking about their experiences with pain and IUDs, do you think that could be politicized?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is an element of urgency and an element of fear. And I think social media also amplifies negative. You know, it sort of has a negative bias. You'll see negative restaurant reviews. You'll see negative movie reviews rather than someone just saying, hey, this is great, you know. There is a sort of bias online already. People turn to social media to complain. And so I think that there's definitely sort of this fear and urgency that can be created, and it can be politicized. But again, in my reporting, I found that women aren't so easily swayed, which is very encouraging. I think women do speak to their physicians, and they do make decisions that are right for them.
Dr. Gurhsahani, earlier in the conversation, Alicia mentioned that there's this backdrop of women not being listened to when they talk about pain, their pain not being really paid attention to historically. Do you think providers are getting better about listening to women overall when it comes to their health concerns and really taking their pain seriously?
I think that is the move with the current generation. And of course, the release of CDC recommendations helps with that. In the last several years, we've also now have the subspecialty of complex family planning within the obstetrics and gynecology world. And I think a lot of the research is stemming from experts in the field who are also contributing both to science and to guidelines. I also think women are hopefully feeling like they can advocate more for themselves, and they're able to bring, they have access to more information online and can bring in their questions. Versus maybe in the past they didn't have access to medical information.
Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Priya Gurhsahani, and New York Times reporter Alicia Haridasani Gupta. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.